watery d'amour, Haïti.
That, my friends, was Josephine Baker. Yes, the Josephine Baker, the famous singer, dancer, and performer. And a song from the 1930s simply called Haiti. It's about 2 minutes before the hour of 7 o'clock. Thanks for listening to What's Left. We know you have a lot of choices out there to do, to make with your time, and whenever you choose to listen to either 88.1 FM or WMBR.org, we appreciate that. So the reason there was sort of a gap there, it was that the CD player didn't want to play the song that I wanted to play from an old, very, very old CDR. Here it goes. I found the one that will play it. Before I go, though, I should mention that one of the projects affiliated with City Life Vita Urbana's attempt to stop housing foreclosures is a project called We Shall Not Be Moved, and it's photographs, stories, and audio stories about the people who have been affected by foreclosures. And if you go to weshallnotbemoved.net, weshallnotbemoved.net, you'll see the work of Kelly Creedon and others, some really, really fine work. And in fact, there's an exhibit up in the Grove Hall branch of the Boston Public Library with some of the pictures and audio from this project. Or you could cocoon in your house and not go out and just go to weshallnotbemoved.net. The professors and the doctors and the other agents of emotional transformation will be from Music for Human Beings will be up next, and I think I'll stick around. My chakra needs a grease and oil change, so I think I'll stick around and see what happens. Let's hear this song, and then the folks from Music for Human Beings will be up next. This is What's Left and WMBR Cambridge.
Yes, marhaban fi music for human. I am Dr. Jalis Sakran, and I welcome you. You are listening on this muggy evening to New Age Talk Radio, and I am here with my illustrious co-hosts and cohortes, Professor Levine and Aurora. Welcome.
Thank you for having us on the show again.
No.
No.
I mean, thank you for having me as well. I think I just spoke the wrong word, which happens occasionally.
Well, the word no is so interesting in that fashion. It has
no.
So many different meanings.
Perhaps.
No, I am not prepared to drive down the street in the middle of the night. No, I am not your child.
This music reminds me of my days as a page in the castle of King Thomas.
Professor Levine, you are so small.
I was small. This, of course, was a former life of mine. But I did have a brief period of time that I spent as a page in one of these castles. And one of my jobs actually was to prepare the bands and the dancers for these festivals. It was a very fun job as a young lad.
I'm surprised that you were ever promoted from paragraph.
Well, in fact, I started as a book, and I was demoted to page.
Indeed, it is the wisest of men that fall into fractions of what they once were.
And now I am but a mere New Age Jewish mystic with many disciples, but very little power.
And who is to say that that is not either punctuation or a series?
Well, punctuation, I think, is one of the greatest inventions of mankind, one of the greatest technologies that we invented. Of course, ancient writing systems lacked any sort of punctuation, and they lacked any sort of space between the words. But it is funny to think that the entire set of inflections and ways we can express ourselves can be merely expressed in a set of five symbols. It's very reductionistic, I think. And I think if one were to invent the set of punctuation marks from scratch, one would have to include a mark for spiritual wisdom.
A mark to indicate that an idea is particularly profound.
Yes, indeed. As in, we know, those of us who play chess know that there's a certain set of conventions when notating the plays in a game. Some of these will be an exclamation mark, which indicates a very good move. A question mark will indicate a poor move. And sometimes the combination of an exclamation point and a question mark can indicate a move which may perhaps be brilliant, but it is not known at this point. Perhaps something
and
like that.
And of course, retroactively, these marks are not wiped, even though the result is known.
So I think in our normal text, we should also have a mark for profundity.
Indeed. Well, you know, in many other languages, there are no marks for punctuation. It is a late addition to many language systems.
Yes.
I believe one which will greatly benefit society as it is today is a mark of sarcasm. For so often we find ourselves in the vast ocean of the internet trying to understand without facial or body expressions or even intonation if a particular person is being sarcastic or realistic.
Now you make the point about the internet. But
what is this internet?
The internet is much like a first foray into meditation. You find yourself accessing a great vastness of subjects, of information, of intriguing new experiences. And the user is at times overwhelmed by the great vastness of the world.
Wait. Does the internet connect us all?
It connects only those who are electronically connected.
But of course, one of the dreams of mankind from its very ancient days was to connect on a broader scale, to have some deep spiritual connection between all human beings and all creatures of the earth. And I wonder sometimes whether the internet is a step towards this deep spiritual connection of all creatures.
Well, I personally believe that the internet is a step in the right direction, but as we cannot, as of yet, link our own emotions and our own spirits to one another, it can often breed misunderstanding and hate.
So we need a brain implant chip, then, I guess.
Or perhaps some greater vulnerability to the waves of the other realms.
I mean, my understanding is that the internet can fly through the air now.
These things are indeed possible, but I think the requirement for these markings is due to the system, the medium itself, that I find rarely it is required in speech to formally indicate semicolon.
Well, of course, well, these marks are but a shadow of the kind of expressive power that one can use when using one's voice, as
and
Aurora surely knows.
That's right. I was going to say, as a vocal therapist, every single mark of punctuation, and even those marks of punctuation which do not exist, are expressed in the human voice. I have just marked the end of that sentence with a period.
But in my mind, the language that is used for writing, a sufficiently expert writer would be able to find means for expressing these emotions that he would ordinarily use the voice for in the writing itself, in the content.
Yes, yes. Well, often constraints on our ability on the form of expression can lead to great creativity and innovation itself. So I think sometimes the very limits imposed upon us by writing can lead to new inventions.
It's always so in art, and in this program, in our art, we are not constrained particularly to have you be a listener. You may also join us and become a speaker. So if you'd like to join us, the number is 617-253-8810. Caller, marhaban.
Mano.
It's what?
Greetings, caller. Everybody.
Welcome to the air.
Greetings.
It's good to be with the MFHB trio. I like the bed music that you have this evening, and I like the topic of punctuation. I've been known to use commas in a very spoken style, and some people, when editing the text that I have written, will start to remove commas, and I will get annoyed for the removal of those commas, because I feel like they are so important for
Now, caller,
indicating where the space is, where someone pauses, like I have just done. So there would be a comma right before I said, like I have just done.
Now, caller, there's a very specific phenomenon for what you are saying. And the problem in itself is that your speech patterns are more halted than your average English speaker. And that is why you believe that there are more commas there than there ought to be, strictly speaking.
Well, I have a recommendation. I think the caller should not put in so many commas, but instead should elongate the spaces between the words.
That would be not unlike what E.E. Cummings did. Is that correct?
Well, E.E. Cummings used to wear the words on his body. So it was more like a spiral rather than just a space.
Well, in my mind, the problem here, caller, is that it may originally have been intended that the comma would indicate a pause, much as the characters themselves may have originally corresponded to sounds, but eventually it becomes dissociated from this original meaning. So,
well, you know what's interesting about that, though, is that here you have a program called Music for Human Beings. And what is language but a form of music? Language is rhythm and melody.
And intonation, that's right, exactly.
And of course, there are some tribes of mystics in the Himalayas who actually practice this very rigorously. They do not speak without a melody. They refuse to ever allow words or any sounds to come out of their mouth unless they are part of a mystical rhythm and melody, which they have intuited as part of the deep melody of the existence of the world, the sort of...
Well, I would argue, Doctor, that one cannot actually speak without melody. In other words, that rhythm and melody cannot separately exist. They are not mutually exclusive. They need each other. And when attempting to use rhythm without melody, one cannot resist having melody part of that. In other words, if you were to listen to what I'm saying and loop it over and over and over and over again, you're going to hear the various different tones that make up a melody. It might not be a sing-songy melody, but it is nevertheless a melody.
Well, caller, I love your point, and I believe that it, in speech patterns, it's definitely true. I must, as a purist, make the distinction that rhythm itself can be without melody. For example, the beat of a drum, the bum, ba-da-dum, bum, ba-da-dum, bum. It doesn't require the melody above it.
Ba-da-bum, bum.
See, now you're adding tones.
You have two different tones that you are articulating there.
I was doing more of a bass line, I think.
No, but when the first drum beat that was articulated had a low note boom, and then the second one was a ba da da
bum,
and then the low note, then you're going back down with a bum.
Bum 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 bum.
Ah,
bum,
even
bum,
in there,
bum, bum,
at the beginning of your phrase, it's ba. So if we were to slow that down, we would hear a. Boom, bow, go down, boom. Even though you're trying to have only one note delivered.
Well, caller, do you think that there's a relationship between music and the afterlife?
Well, let me address this point first. Now, there's a difference between actual melody and, for example, a vocal diphthong. It is very difficult, or say impossible, to have a single pure note emitted from a human voice. If you were to take, for example, a spectral look at the noise, but if you were to take a percussion instrument or perhaps a computer instrument, then you could produce that pure tone.
I agree with you, and I guess, but going back to the language issue, it would be inhuman, or it would be rather impossible to have language without a human involved, as we define language.
Exactly, which is why, as I said, your statement for speech patterns was definitely an excellent one, and it's an excellent observation.
I want to generalize this a little bit, because I think this is a great line of thought, to think that all of language, but it's not just a single human being, it's the totality of human existence, all the network of conversations and communications, that itself is like one big song.
Agreed.
And so we're all part of this huge musical instrument, which is
an orchestral arrangement.
We're all a little piece of this musical enterprise, and by communicating like we're doing over the air, in person, over the person, we are playing our role in this symphonic orchestra.
Could the Big Bang be considered the CD release party? or a record release party more generally?
Well, there, it's not true that there can be something from nothingness. I believe that before the Big Bang, the universe was a cacophony of noises, all concentrating and emanating from one point. And this explosion, this so-called, which we don't even know is true, this Big Bang theory. What would have happened was these tones would have spread out and diluted throughout the entire universe as it expanded. And different bits of the music could have been concentrated in certain points, and perhaps that's what created the different planets and stars, was different concentrations of beautiful sounds.
I've heard the expression, the music of the spheres. Mm. Anybody tell me what that means?
Music of the what?
The music of the spheres.
Spheres,
of the celestial spheres?
I thought you said sea urchins.
No, I'm sure they have their own music.
If you look at any of the celestial bodies, which are all somewhat spherical, they are all emitting a music. They are all emitting radio waves, actually. And there's a certain beauty and music to each of these noises, which, when put together, you'll hear the symphony of the universe.
That's an interesting corollary between the radio waves that are responsible for us understanding and discovering the Big Bang, and the noise in the universe and all the radio telescopes, and the fact that, you know, to quote Steve Perry, we were raised on radio here, and we originally found our music on radio, and still we have music that travels along radio waves, to quote Roger from Pink Floyd. His name, last name, escapes me for some reason.
Roger.
And we are ourselves also emitting radio waves at all times, so we are all influencing one another in that fashion.
I did once have this subject investigated scientifically. I wanted to know what radio waves were being emitted by my own brain. And so I went for this testing, and it turns out that I emit on a loop Bach's Air in G string, just on a continuous loop. Every 2 minutes, my brain repeats this and sends it out.
I have when I was similarly analyzed, the radio waves that were emitting from me were Johnny Most's Havlicek Stole the Ball in a loop.
It's fascinating. Mine are simply different varieties of noise.
I'd like to think a little about this this thing the caller mentions on the music of the spheres. Because there is a lot of music in every sphere. I think about spheres as they move through the air and they are lifted. They are lifted due to rotation.
You have a question about that perhaps is a way to two-dimensionalize what you're mentioning in the spheres.
Mm-hmm.
We have, in a two-dimensional world, Venn diagrams, which are very powerful for explaining interactions between different spheres of activity. Can there be a three-dimensional Venn diagram that is actually real in existence? So two spheres interloping, if you will.
Well, I do know that it's been proved, apparently, that all of modern physics can be expressed in five Venn diagrams. I think that was proven by Gödel in the late 70s.
Well, I must ask you, caller, what the significance of each of these spheres is. If each of these individual spheres were to contain one subject, much like a Venn diagram, then it would collapse similarly in the two dimensions.
Right, but the doctor mentions five Venn diagrams. Now, is that five Venn diagram is made up of two circles each, or would that be one Venn diagram that is actually made up of five circles, not unlike the Olympic symbol?
Actually, I believe it was five Venn diagrams, which have to be rotated in three-dimensional space. Each of the Venn diagrams itself is two-dimensional, contain up to 10 spheres. But then each of them should be placed on a cardboard cutout and sort of rotated in a particular configuration so that these five Venn diagrams express, in some way, all the discoveries of modern physics.
In my view on the caller's original question is perhaps physical analogies of the Venn diagram might be if you have spotlights intersecting in a stage, and so then a three-dimensional version of that might be clouds of gases, perhaps, where different regions correspond to the different mixtures.
I'll go with that. You know, I can't disagree with that particular line of thinking.
Who is Venn, anyway?
I think Wikipedia would be able to tell us precisely the
I think he was a German or Viennese aristocrat, is that right?
After someone passes from this world, what they are is only a representation of what they have left behind. So to us, Venn is a group of circles intersecting.
Well, I always say that now and then. Now and then.
Well, and many Germans, of course, along the same lines would ask you when you might say it.
And apparently Venn was a nobleman himself, and his full name was Venn van Venn.
So this sort of supports the theory that it is a Germanic origin.
Mm.
But if it were a German name, it would be pronounced Fenn.
But how wonderful is it to have something as wonderful as the Venn diagram named after you? We have many things that are named after people. We have theorems and axioms and apparently diagrams. And I wonder what kind of thing would we want to have named after ourselves?
Perhaps if, not things such as...
If your name were Mandelbrot, would you want it used to describe everything that describes everything? Or would you have it be a generic name that is completely has nothing to do with you?
I think that if I could choose a name, it might be soap or something similar.
Well, the question I'm asking is, what would you like your legacy to humanity to be? What would you like named after you? Would you like it to be a method for building bridges? A proof of the existence of spiritual knowledge?
So I personally would not like anything named after me, but I would like a legacy of spiritual children that I would leave me, a progeny.
Ah, but they don't need to know that they came from you. You don't care about the acknowledgement.
No. I think it is irrelevant.
Irrelevant. It's mere vanity.
If you had spiritual children, one would assume then that one could have spiritual grandparents, spiritual cousins.
Oh, absolutely.
Spiritual...
there can be spiritual incest as well.
Absolutely. There is no reason... that you might not trace back the ancestor of a particular thought or way of life or belief.
I believe that a lot of us are experiencing life as a pebble skips across the pond. And I think to myself at times, oh, Aurora, what a wonderful discovery you've made. And then upon further reflection, realize that this discovery is indeed thousands of years old.
I'm afraid I must leave the circle right now because I'm just about to meet up with some friends who I can certainly continue the conversation with, and I will
our circle in the spiritual planes.
I appreciate you having me. I think music for human beings is absolutely one of the most powerful programs that is being broadcast across the radio waves and airwaves of this area, and of course all around the world via that internet that you said that lives in the air. Good night, everyone.
Thank you so much joining us, caller, and for also making us powerful and making yourself powerful.
I often find myself experiencing bursts of reality at once, and then stretches of unreality that I will later wake up from.
That's an interesting thought. I find that most of my days are filled with reality. But there is this thought, this story that I was reading in this book. I think the author is David Eagleton. It's a book about, I think we might have a caller.
Yeah, let's bring someone else on the air. And if you'd like to join in, the number is 617-253-8810. Caller, marhaban.
Hey, I didn't want to interrupt the story, so...
Well, I was just going to relate the story. This is a book about tales of the afterlife. It's 40 tales of the afterlife. Very, very fascinating read. And so this one story is based on the idea that the afterlife is very much like our current life. It's basically the content is identical to our current life, but it's merely ordered in a different way, so that instead of having things go based on time, instead all our experiences are lumped together based on the quality of the experience. So some examples the author gives are the fact that in this reliving of our life after death, we sleep for 30 years without break. We flip through magazines for 5 months while sitting on the toilet.
I personally flip through books while sitting on the toilet.
Well, but, you know, what, be as it may, we all do something, and so we all, in this version of the afterlife, would, for example, spend 6 weeks waiting for a green light straight, 7 hours of vomiting straight, 14 minutes of pure joy.
That is such a sad thought.
3 years swallowing food.
That's one honor.
Well, one would thank their creator for a short life.
But then the final point is that you spend 4 minutes in this life wondering what your life would be like if you reshuffled the order of events. In this part of the afterlife, you imagine something analogous to your earthly life, and the thought is blissful. A life where episodes are split into tiny swallowable pieces, where moments do not endure, where one experiences the joy of jumping from one event to the next, like a child hopping from spot to spot on the burning sand. That's the conclusion of the story. I think it really brings a powerful metaphor to the idea that there's something nice about the way we live our lives, about the fact that we jump from one event to the next and our emotions can change from 1 minute to the next. This variety.
I like that because there's so many things that I've forget about that I'd like to jump back to eventually.
Right.
I want to highlight reel to save all that stuff. Spent a lot of time doing it.
Now, caller, how are you doing today?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Yes, I am.
Good. Yes, go ahead.
I was only thinking about your previous comment. It seems to me that there is too much focus, or there can be a great deal more focus than is required on particular experiences, when one may focus on the change that one is experiencing in their brain, so that the resulting brain state is the one that should be cherished and not the particular moment.
That does require a bit of meta awareness.
But it's bizarre because I find often that I have to remind others to enjoy the journey, but now I'm telling you that perhaps you are focusing too much on the journey and do not forget the destination, the change.
And the way stations.
Precisely.
And this is even true when there is no purpose, when there is no ultimate goal or ultimate change.
Well, this, I think, can be a powerful technique for enduring pain. One can actually be aware of the pain, whether it's emotional or physical pain, and find some beauty, some stimulation, and some vibrancy of life and being in the awareness of this extreme emotion, the awareness of what's going on inside one's mind and brain and soul.
Yeah, but you know what you can't do that with? nausea and discomfort, like itchiness.
It's harder. It's harder, but I think it's still possible to somewhat step away.
Maybe. I don't know. I wonder, because I'm sure there's some Buddhist monks out there that could have the itchiest itching powder poured all over and into them, and they'd be okay. But I wonder if that's because they dull their reaction to it and kind of are able to shut the feeling off, whereas what we're talking about here is dealing with the full spectrum of that initial sensation.
Well, there's two counterpoints to this. There's two parts. There's understanding the sensation and dealing with it, and then there's overcoming it if it's something that's purely physical. For example, migraines, or tension headaches, which can be, one can say, meditated away when you put yourself in that other mindset and allow your biophysiology to be affected by your calm state of mind.
Yeah.
Well, isn't that essentially redirecting one's attention, one's focus?
Not exactly. Sometimes in order to overcome these headaches, you must concentrate on the headache itself. Imagine the blood coursing through constricted blood vessels in your head. And concentrating on opening them up. Concentrate on the pain itself and in soothing it and allowing it to wash away like the waves of the ocean.
So, but in essence, the end result is that one ends up sort of shifting one's concentration from the constriction of the blood to the opening of the blood. So one is binding one's mind to the experience and then moving one's mind and the brain along with it.
Exactly.
That is an interesting technique. I mean, personally, I have found the idea of redirecting attention to be powerful. I think it's not quite perhaps as powerful as the technique that you're referring to. But even just refocusing one's mind can be very powerful, and one can learn how to do this effectively by practice. One can actually practice these. There are these exercises one can attempt where you learn how to focus your attention on various things and not be distracted by other things. So if one is experiencing pain or sadness, one can redirect one's thought to something else.
I think some sensations by their own nature are inescapable. They're built into your brain in a certain way so that your attention must be tended to them.
Right.
There is so much plasticity to the mind. I think actually that given sufficient opportunity to train, one may learn gradually to deal with any stimulus.
Well, the female chest has been postulated as one of these stimuli that the male human is incapable of not paying attention to.
There have been
apparently it's good for you too. There's a new study that says it sheds 3 years off your life if you look at boobs 10 minutes a day.
There's been a lot of government research, top secret, on affecting one's staring patterns, let's say. At the form of that they are attracted to. And the research has been very conclusive that the mind is very bendable and it is very trainable through the use of shock therapy, through the use of abhorrent smells, all sorts of things.
What sort of smells work? Because I wanted to do some of that and I was wondering if I could do it myself.
It is usually for developing a distaste.
Okay, so what if I want to develop a positive taste for something?
That is not successful.
You can never sensitize yourself? You can only desensitize yourself?
So far in the world, in the physicality of the world, but through...
That's terrible.
Through mental exercises, through accessing your own spirituality, your own self on the higher planes, you can allow yourself to have positive emotions towards things like your work, for example.
Okay.
I mean, some people find the smell of their own armpits to be comforting in a certain way.
Sometimes they're just nasty, though.
Oh, absolutely.
Sometimes it's bad.
Especially others. But,
Well, I was referring to one's own armpits.
Of course.
Yeah.
They mimic the smells of one's mother.
Your armpits are... Oh, you're just... I thought you said it first. Your armpit smells like your mother.
That's what I heard also.
That's true, when it is not extremely pungent.
Well, I wanted to mention another form, another method of entrainment, which is the use of binaural beats to affect one's brainwave frequency.
I've done that a couple times.
What kind of beats are these?
It's binaural beats.
Beats. I think you said beads.
No, it is due to the mixture of two waves that occurs. Yes.
These are the e-drugs that
neurologically
are being discussed now in the media.
Well, e-drugs. I mean, it is a sound.
It's a sound.
But apparently the sound that can mimic the effects of narcotics.
This has not been my experience.
Hmm. Well, what narcotic can do that? It's better than narcotics.
Juice, I think orange juice, perhaps. It is no more
orange juice.
No more
orange Julius, maybe.
So binaural, meaning that there's a separate beat for each ear. Is that correct?
The waves are not. So it is two waves which are of similar frequency. So when they combine, it will form a beat which is at the difference of the two frequencies. However, they never physically combine. Each wave is delivered to each ear, and the beat is formed within the brain.
I see. So the brain has to be active.
It is a neurological process.
Your brain is part of the stereo system.
Precisely.
Now, I must warn listeners to be careful if you have some oral problems, especially with your neuroconnectivity. This can lead to nausea and vomiting.
Really?
I've only ever had very positive experiences with it.
Yes, as I say, it's only for those who have certain problems.
Mm-hmm. But I could imagine a method for associating certain stimuli with certain brainwave frequencies by using the binaural beat technique.
Well, I have heard it claimed that if you study, that you should study for an exam with a particular scent. So let's say you take some cloth and you dip it in some perfume or some scent which you find very pleasant. It could be what's the word for this? There's this scent that hippies used to like.
Patchouli.
Patchouli, yeah, patchouli. What's the story behind patchouli?
I don't know. It's an oil.
Why did hippies like it so much?
They use it to clean their bongs, I think, a lot.
Okay. Well, anyway, so you can use patchouli or any other kind of scent, and you scent your cloth, and you study, and every few minutes you take a whiff of this scented cloth while you're studying. You sort of keep this scent omnipresent. And it turns out then that the knowledge that you learn will become strongly associated with that scent, so that when you smell that scent in the future, your brain can quickly retrieve all those sources of information that have been stored. So then you take the cloth with you to the exam, and if you have any difficulty with any question, you simply... you smell that cloth, that smell, and it brings forth the rush of memories from your studying. And I think you can do this.
But what if someone else has another scent, like an armpit scent, that throws you off?
Yeah, that could be problematic. But I think you can actually do this with love as well. You can learn to associate your loved one with a particular scent, and then people do this, of course. They take something that reminds them, some piece of clothing of their loved one which has their scent, and it brings forth the rush of emotions.
But I think...
What if you're dead to the world and you don't love anything? Is there a way to bring that back?
Bring back the deadness?
The love.
Well,
all these
methods that we have been describing are by association and reinforcement. So if a sensation is dead completely, if now no stimulus can bring this sensation forward, then none of these methods will be able to make it stronger.
I think you need surgery in that case, probably.
There's something called empathy training that you can do with Buddhist meditation, right? And you just think about positive emotions flowing to people and just feel bad about people and stuff. And that trains you to be more empathetic instead of just switching the empathy around. So it's strengthening and making more emotions where there weren't as many emotions before.
But I think Dr. Jalas was saying that you need some base to start with. You need some seed emotion.
And you need a seed.
I think that if you're totally dead to the world, then surgery is probably called for, some sort of surgical solution which can rewire your brain to feel empathy once again.
Well, how much is that, though?
There is actually an affliction. I can't remember the name. It's a dysphoria.
Or dysthymia.
Yeah, that thing. Where people actually cannot feel emotions very strongly at all. There are some emotions they cannot feel. And they have therapeutic therapies for these afflictions. So surgery
really?
is a last resort.
Well, of course, I was referring to the case where the emotions are totally gone, not just where they're blunted. I think if they're blunted, then one can sharpen them a bit.
Mm-hmm. But, so if in a situation where you go to Iraq and you just see lots of killings and stuff, and then you're totally desensitized to killing and you don't have any empathetic response if you see a murder, like Dexter, for example, there's no brain damage there, but there's really no empathy left.
Well, it's not that the empathy is gone or that these feelings are gone. They are deeply buried by intense pain and suffering, and so one must work through the scabs and dig through them and open up a wound in oneself, in one's soul, and unleash all those negative poisons that are underneath the soul.
Yeah, okay.
Precisely.
So that's a different thing.
Yeah, it's not that it is completely gone. It is possible to surgically, if one finds the center of a particular emotion. So emotion, it's a difficult one because it is so distributed within the brain, but for example, particular visual sensations or the ability to produce intelligible speech, these are loci within the brain that are well known. And so it is possible to remove these surgically, and if the person is of a sufficiently advanced age, this ability will never be recovered. Will never be fully recovered.
Mm.
So it can very much be a tragic thing. But in these cases, it is a psychological damage that I think is reversible.
Yes. Let me ask another question. So there are strengthening things. If you wanted to strengthen the depth of emotion, you could do something about that. So what exactly? Are there exercises that you can do, or meditations, directed meditation? Or
I can speak to this. I actually, in my youth, I was unable to feel many emotions. I was, as you can say, blunted. And I learned that in order to feel the emotions, apart from medication, what you could do is look deep into yourself and access that emotion. And let it swallow you, and let yourself feel it with every inch of your body. And it may not be as strong as it ought to, and it can help to listen to music that mimics that emotion.
I think,
and to allow yourself to sing along with that music, to allow your entire soul to be washed in it.
I think we're all multidimensional beings, meaning that we all experience many different emotions at once, of varying degrees. So for example, at any given time I may be experiencing just a little bit of jealousy, a great amount of joy, and a little bit of maybe excitement
or ennui.
Yeah. So I think one of the methods of meditation to strengthen a particular emotion is to focus it on one and isolate that emotion from all the others. So,
that's
for example,
right.
One can learn to accentuate, let's say, excitement by meditating and removing all the other emotions involved and just focusing on a mono-emotional experience at once and building that up for various emotions. And then once you have each one down, learning to combine them in new whole ways.
Now, caller, are you asking about yourself in particular?
Yes. Well, I'm interested in empathy treatment. I think, to some extent, just through watching movies and whatnot, I've just been desensitized to violence and, I don't know, just all that stuff. So
in earlier in my career, in more unsavory times, electroshock therapy might be recommended to reset the brain.
But, now, can I do that myself?
No. My advice to you, caller, is to live your life and have full experiences, and then these will give you an appreciation for the reality.
Now, and I also just wanted to add on to that from your voice, from your intonation, that you are not without empathy in any way. You are perhaps just a little jovial, and that is a good thing. But if you were to see a violent crime in front of you with your eyes in this physical realm, I believe that you would find that you would feel it as strongly as you ought to.
Maybe. But I've seen Two Girls, One Cup, and I watched it the whole time. And the third time I saw it, I was eating chips, and it didn't bother me at all. That worries me a little bit.
It doesn't mean anything, Carla. From your voice, you are well-centered, well-balanced.
I wouldn't be so concerned about the Two Girls, One Cup experience. There is sort of a paradox, though, that we have been talking about strengthening emotions and experiences through repetition. And that's true, that one can treat the ability to experience joy or other emotions as a sort of a muscle of the soul, of the spirit. And that muscle can be strengthened, but it can also be weakened through overuse. And I think if one, for example, were to become an assassin, then one would lose the ability to empathize with one's victims.
Well, that's the opposite, though. That's desensitization.
Right, so that's a paradox, a little bit of a paradox here, right?
Not exactly, because in one sense, you are welling yourself in that emotion. When you are exercising your emotional muscle, you are allowing it to wash over you and to soak into you. Whereas when you are witnessing a violent crime on television, for example, you are not doing that. You are only exercising your eyes and desensitizing and atrophying your emotional muscle.
Well, I guess one question I would ask is, if one were to live one's life in pure joy all the time, would that joy become less meaningful?
No one would understand what that joy is.
But I would posit that one needs the full spectrum of emotions to appreciate any single one of them.
Exactly.
The description of enlightenment that I've heard from the few people I've spoken to who have reached it, say that it is sort of this odd combination of every emotion, but turned into this super emotion that goes much further and beyond and deeper than any of the other ones. But it's sort of the full spectrum of everything worked into one. But it feels good.
I mean, to me, I think that that if you feel, as Professor Levine mentions, just as though you hold a nose in front of your eyes all the time, you will not even see the nose after a while. So if you continuously experience a particular sensation, it will disappear. So there is this this importance that that the experiences of life are not continuous, not constant, that there must be interruption.
Luckily, I have a pretty big schnoz, so it's not really as much of a problem for me.
Yes.
Have you ever experimented with painting it? Because your attention to it is definitely lower. But if you attempt to paint it, if you color your nose, even for one day, you will find that you are constantly looking at it, being surprised by it.
And you know what I do is I put mirrors on it, on either side of the nostril, and that way I can see a little bit behind me when I look in the right way. And I don't have to look as much at my nose also.
And do you find that if someone approaches you from the left, from behind, do you jump towards the left because you are seeing it on the right? Or have you been trained?
Yeah.
Have you trained yourself to realize that it is on the left and therefore jump to the opposite direction?
Well, I see it works out fine because the direction that I see the person in is actually in the same direction that they're coming from.
I believe
in the way that I set it up.
Paneling his nose with mirrors.
Well, I think this nose painting actually goes back to what we were talking about before, with that focus on individual emotions at a time, isolating a single emotion, and then sort of methodically building up our strength and our ability to experience each one, and then combining them into this Buddhist whole. So one can actually paint one's nose a particular color or tone in order to focus one's emotions on a particular feeling of the day. Perhaps the blues for one day, one can paint one's nose blue, or gold for excitement and joy.
Mm-hmm. Can you do this with color contacts as well?
Because you do not see the color, I think it's unlikely. But another form of entrainment. And caller, thank you for being with us. Unfortunately, the hour is so gone.
Sorry.
No. Caller, no, it has been splendid.
It's been a pleasure.
No, I'm trying to be sorry for a while now.
It's not a bad idea, I think.
Take care.
Let us all be
a good place to start.
Briefly apologetic.
I'm really sorry.
Namaste,
Dr. Jalas. I stole your shoes yesterday.
Professor Levine, I'm very sorry.
I'm sorry.
I stole your food and
for hitting you with a shoe
and
on the head.
Your spirit and Aurora, I stole your voice.
And Aurora, I'm sorry for interrupting you twice today.
I am sorry for nothing.
And to all of our callers, I must apologize for the hour. And if you'd like to be with us again, we will be here next Friday at 7 p.m., as we are every Friday at 7 p.m. here on WMBR Cambridge 88.1 FM on Music for Human. Stay tuned for Hipster Happy Hour. Ma'a salama.
Safety.
Number one,
cars and bikes stop at red lights.
It's against the law for car drivers or bicycle riders to ignore traffic signals.
So don't buzz through red lights. There might be a pedestrian or turning car that doesn't see you coming.
Number two,
look first before you open your door.
Numerous bicyclists have been injured or even killed by car doors suddenly opening into them.
Look first, and bicyclists, stay out of the door zone.
Number three,
cross with the signal.
You are safest if you wait for a walk or green traffic signal.
Don't jaywalk. That's just walking into trouble.
Number four,
cars and bikes should stop for pedestrians and unsignalized crosswalks.
Be nice. Be legal. Be safe.
Brought to you as a public service by the Cambridge Bicycle Committee and this station.
I've been rapping for about 17 years, okay? I don't write my stuff anymore. I just kick it from my head, you know what I'm saying? I can do that. No disrespect, but that's how I am.
Hey, so you're listening to Delizzo, Nakoma right now. I'm subbing for Hipster Happy Hour, so I hope you enjoy yourself. You're listening to WMBR Cambridge, and we're going to begin with Asher Roth.
$1,500 another. Yeah, yeah, yo, this one's for the people. All the bees that are bleeding and sleeping, and he should breathe. I thought we all equal. Ain't a man on the God's green bee underneath any other. I don't wanna play preacher, but I swear they turn an ear when we talk about peace and love. Sometimes might need a hug. Yeah, we all wanna come on up above, but this ain't about Jesus. No way, no Abe, no Ike, Moses, or Muhammad. Yeah, it's all about believing. Full steam ahead, because you know the worst times are behind me.
don't wanna sound cheesy, but it's just to really mean it. Yeah, I'm telling, I can feel it. It's the reason I don't sleep, I'll be way too geek tonight. This one's for all of y'all, I'm the same as all of y'all. I'm on my shit, I work real hard enough for every little bit that I get, but this is all.